Hey, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 298 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us tonight on our final episode of the regular season. In a little bit, we have Allison talking about the pneumometer and the DeGrometer, although she will not be covering DeGrom's last start that is saved for next week. And we're going to have Steve Saipa doing his regular update on the minor league system, which has been super fun this year. I know we have it every week, but I haven't really talked about it. I love what Steve does for the show, and I'm super happy that he's a part of our show. And I think that if you listen to this podcast, it's a great way to get a glimpse into the minor league world if you're not somebody who necessarily can follow it as closely. Like, for me personally, I don't really have a scout's eye at all. I couldn't do half of what Steve does from an analysis standpoint just by, you know, the eye test. So hearing someone like Steve talk about it is amazing, and I'm really glad we have that on our show. And so Steve will be up in a little while. But first, Chris McShane and I are back together for the second time in a while, but it feels like Chris and I were doing this for, you know, years without a break, and now we've been doing some other stuff, and so it's kind of weird, but it's great to get Chris back. And we're going to talk about the end of the season and David Wright Day on Saturday and a few more things, so check it out. Well, Chris, we are recording as the Mets are playing their final game of the year against the Atlanta Braves. They are currently up 4-1. Jason Vargas had an excellent start tonight, believe it or not. Went 7 innings, struck out 6, didn't walk anybody, I believe 3 hits. Mets are, I said, they're up 4-1 now. The bullpen coughed up one run. But overall, the Mets have been playing better over the last 3 or 4 weeks than they have been at any point since, I guess we'll call it, April. So what are you seeing from the Mets in late August and September? And does this give you any confidence for 2019?
Well, it's sort of the foundation of it, you know. You have 4 young hitters who are all playing either pretty well or really well. And that, to me, is really the biggest takeaway. I mean, it's a combination of the fact that the starting pitching, even bad, Noah Syndergaard hasn't been bad by like normal standards. You know, he's been fine this year. It's just when you have Jacob DeGrom putting up one of the best seasons in franchise and baseball history, really. You know, when you have that, and Zach Wheeler having such a strong second half, you know, Syndergaard looks sort of pedestrian in comparison, but he's still been good. So those 3, and then the 4 hitters, McNeil in particular, just because it's, you know, he's kind of the shiny new toy. Conforto getting back to what we all know he's capable of. And, you know, we talked about it over the course of the winter, the spring, and early this season. Conforto getting back to form wasn't something that we were certain was going to happen just because of the way he got injured, right. You know? So those 2, obviously Brandon Nimmo has remained really good. You know, his stat line is going to look nice at the end of the season, no matter what. And then Rosario, there's still a little more that needs to happen, but you know,
starting to look like a more well-rounded player.
Right. Yeah, he's been doing better at the plate, and I think it seems to have made him more comfortable in the field. You know, I'm not ready to say, like, he's going to make the All-Star team next year, but, you know, this is good signs from a guy who we know has talent and a prospect pedigree, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, and tonight the Mets put those 4 hitters in the first 4 slots in the lineup, which is essentially what they should have been doing since, I don't know, July. But better late than never. At least they've been playing them regularly. You know, these last few games, get them as many reps as you can. Yeah.
And, you know, I have to think the Mets front office listens to the podcast. I have to think that. In part because
Jose Reyes
hasn't been playing very much, which is, you know, obviously a podcast favorite topic. And also, Dom Smith's been getting a little bit more of a look in the field. And I am still not sold on Dom Smith, but the last few weeks of Dom Smith have been a big improvement.
Yeah, so that was something that, you know, is As we're coming into recording tonight, I was just looking a little bit, you know, we're not quite at the end of the season, but we're getting to that point where we're reflecting on the season that was. And I was just looking at the second half splits. And with Smith, it's not a lot of plate appearances because they haven't played him that much. But I didn't really realize that, you know, in that time, he's hit really well. You know, I don't know if I buy it, but it's, I'd rather see that than not.
Right. Well, it's hard because when he first was brought back up, he made a couple of those terrible plays. Remember? He cost the team the game because of a dropped ball in the outfield or because he collided with someone in the outfield. You know, he just had some really terrible plays in the field that just made you so upset that he was out there playing in left field that I think even when it didn't even good for the next week or two after that, at least my attitude was like, well, he still shouldn't be he still shouldn't be playing the outfield. He still shouldn't be doing X, Y, and Z. And so
right.
It took a while to sort of let that slide away and to sort of take him a bit at face value and see what was happening with him, you know, legitimately. And look, I still don't think he's the first baseman of the future, but if he's a useful player, I'm happy to have him on the roster, at least temporarily.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, I'd rather have him, you know, show signs of this and at least go into 2019 feeling like he could be useful in some capacity, you know, that benefits the Mets.
Yeah, absolutely. So we touched on it briefly a second ago about Zach Wheeler's strong second half. Wheeler was shut down, I guess, about 10 days ago now. You know, just he had been there were a couple of games. What was the one game? Did he have a shutout going into the after the eighth inning, or just a complete game? And he basically said, like, I'm gassed. Pull me out of the game. You know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was 8 innings, 80-something pitches, yeah. Shutout.
And, you know, so he's just been getting exhausted, and he hasn't pitched this much in quite some time. And so the Mets shut him down just, you know, partially for health reasons, partially just for exhaustion. But Wheeler's second half, I mean, it's impressive no matter how you look at it. But when you remember that he started the year in AAA, and when you remember that
yeah. –
you know, he really hasn't been a stable part of this rotation in years now. I think his name has to be in consideration for comeback player of the year. Don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and this is a guy who, you know, he missed two full seasons. He came back last year and he just didn't pitch all that much. And he wasn't good either. So, and his season ended early. Because of concerns about his health. So, you know, you add all that up, and this is a guy who came back and was one of the best pitchers in baseball, really, for this, three, 4 months? You know, the fact that he started where he did and wound up with a 3.31 ERA at the end of the season, that's pretty impressive. And it's his best single season mark now. You know, it's sort of like a scattered sampling of when those innings and games were pitched. But, you know, this was just shy of being a career high in innings. It's his best career mark in ERA. His walk rate was better than ever. His home run rate matched, you know, his best previous mark in a single season. So, you just look at all this stuff and you look at the way he was throwing, you know, increased velocity, the split change or splitter, whatever you want to call it, and kind of ditching the traditional changeup. You know, he wasn't a strikeout machine. You know, you see some starting pitchers who will strike out 10 or more batters per nine innings. Some of them have been on the Mets either this year or recently. But, man, like you put all that together, and it was disappointing to hear they were shutting him down only because I just wanted to see more. Like, I totally get it. You can go into next year saying, hey, he can throw, you know, 200 innings or throw 200 innings, and if things really go well, be a guy who's there in the playoffs. if he can establish that kind of durability, that will mean really good things for him as he works his way toward free agency. But man, like, yeah, you add all that up. A guy misses two full years, has a crappy year, and then does this. You know, I maybe I'm just ignoring players on other teams who have been in similar positions, but I think he's sort of a lock for that.
I hope so, for his sake. You know, Wheeler was at a time, you know, when Wheeler was traded for 3 months of Carlos Beltran, he was considered one of the best prospects in baseball, and then almost instantly became a second thought for the Mets when Harvey debuted, and then Syndergaard and DeGrom, and he's been sort of left behind. And I'm not saying that because I feel sorry for him, because, you know, he's a professional athlete making millions of dollars and is very, very good at what he does. I'm just saying that because he never – you always got the impression that he wasn't living up to his potential or to his hype. And so to see him able to do that is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and, you know, just to do it at a time when things – like, I'm sure it kills him that he wasn't there for 2015 to be around as part of that
right
season. But at a time that the Mets and Mets fans need things to just look like, hey, here's something that's, you know, maybe we can kind of latch onto for 2019 – you know, that's big. And sort of getting back to your first question, you know, all of this is good. It gives you something to say, okay, it's possible that they could be good. You know, if Wheeler had another season where he threw 100 innings and had mixed results and all that, and, you know, even if DeGrom and Syndergaard did exactly the same thing, but maybe McNeil or Conforto wasn't totally on fire to end the year, you take away a few of those pieces and you feel like, man, you know, this team doesn't like to spend money. Where are they going to get back to being good? You know, the concern is still the same. All right, I'm going to buy in to all of these guys. You know, DeGrom and Syndergaard were established, but Wheeler and then the four hitters that we talked about, I'm still concerned about spending. I'm very concerned about the bullpen. You know, no Met fan in their right mind is going to say, oh, yeah, they're great. They're going to be contending immediately in 2019. But, you know, it's you can be more optimistic than you maybe would have expected.
Yeah, you know, I think it was last night on the broadcast, Keith had said that he felt the Mets have enough offense to compete next year. And I kind of, you know, cocked my head to the side and said, really, Keith? You know, I don't know if I see that. But then he went on to kind of clarify that if everybody's healthy, and I guess he includes Cespedes in that, and I'm sure there's a way to squint your eyes and look at everybody being healthy and the team being set offensively. But I think more than that, I just get the feeling, you know, we talked a lot last offseason about how we, and especially you, felt the Mets needed another starting pitcher or two. And, you know, I don't think that need has gone away. But I think we now have a much better idea of what all the starting pitchers are capable of. And so, if nothing else, I feel like the team now has a bit more of a – what's I'm looking for? Like, I feel like now their needs for next year are more clearly laid out than they were at this time of last year. And so that makes me feel slightly optimistic as a Mets fan that, you know, hopefully a new GM will be coming in with a fresh set of eyes, and they can look at what is clearly a team in need of a bullpen makeover and, you know, hopefully a Manny Machado addition. And,
right. I mean, hey, I'm all for demanding it all off season because it should be the demand.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you see, you know, you'll get fans. I think of any team. Sometimes it feels like it's exclusive to us. We have our own special state of mind with the Mets, but it's probably every team. You'll have fans rationalize like, oh, but where would you play Manny Machado? I don't know, on your team, in the lineup every day. Yeah. Like, everybody else can move around. We can figure this one out. You know, if that means Machado's got to suck it up and make money playing third base, or Frazier, you know, and that would result in Frazier not playing as much, or
trading Frazier, you know, or, you know,
right,
getting the however much Frazier's owed for next year.
Right. So, you know, that would be a fantastic problem to have. So yeah, if you're a Mets fan, you know, and I think I had written something on the site, over a month ago now, but you know, they're talking as they're in their just miserable middle of the summer, they're talking about, oh, well, we think we can be good in 2019. And I wrote a thing like, well, they need to sign Manny Machado if they're serious about this, you know? And people, I get it. People would be like, well, that's not the reality. So, ha ha, yeah, sure, whatever. But like, no, that's what Mets fans should be demanding. It would be perfect for what they need. You know, you can rationalize not signing Harper better to me than Machado.
The Mets already have 9 outfielders or something crazy like that, you know.
Right. Like, you hope Cespedes will return to a productive form. But even if he doesn't, you know, they have Nimmo and Conforto, and Harper's not a center fielder either. And with the reality of the budget being limited somewhere, I can rationalize that and be a little more okay with it. But if they were willing to like go get Manny Machado, man, I'll buy a ticket plan again.
I mean, look, if Machado plays third, I see no argument here for why you wouldn't want to go out and get Machado. And look,
right,
I love Ahmed Rosario. I think Ahmed Rosario has a bright future as a major leaguer. That said, if Manny Machado will only come here if he plays shortstop, hey, guess what? Manny Machado's been starting third shortstop next year, and we'll move Rosario someplace else, or we'll figure something out. That's okay.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
I feel like I am totally fine with the traditional grumpy Mets fan. What I'm not fine with is the Mets fan that, when presented with optimistic ideas, refuses to even consider them.
Yeah.
We all know people like that.
Yeah. And we should be, you know, I'm not participating in any boycotts or, you know, anything like that. But we should at least be willing to demand that they do something that's the best and not just, you know, half measures.
Yeah. It seems like I would think that when bringing in a new GM, they're going to have to talk a talk during the interview process that we are willing to spend a bit this year. And I feel like maybe they will spend more this season than they will next season, because they want first-year GM to be happy and do his job. If that's the case, this might be the Machado perfect storm.
Right. Yeah, that would be ideal. Sign me up.
But we need to touch a little bit here on Jacob deGrom's last start. And we're going to spend probably a full episode in the next month or so just talking about deGrom's season, digging a little bit deeper, maybe having some guests on to talk about deGrom stuff. But, you know, last night deGrom pitched his final start of 2018. He went 8 innings. He gave up 2 hits, struck out 10, walked none, and notched his 1,000th career strikeout in the process. If there was any doubt that deGrom was going to be the National League Cy Young Award winner, it seemed like last night giving him a winning record of 10-9, putting him in double digits and in a winning record, seems like that probably silences most of the grumps who care about pitcher wins when it comes to the Cy Young stuff. So at this point, do you feel confident in DeGrom winning the National League Cy Young Award? And if not, what's wrong with you?
You know, I do. You know, when I know sometimes beat writers might come off as being, you know, maybe a little bit favorable to players they cover who are eligible, you know, who have the credentials for these kinds of awards. But, you know, when you sort of have a complete consensus from New York baseball writers that somebody on the Mets is a lock to win an award, you know, I feel like it's a little bit different with the Yankees, where they might be a little more prone to romanticize and, you know, just kind of buy into all of this success and blah, 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 you know, your standard Yankee fan thing. So even then, I think they could, it would be something to say that they're all thinking it, but especially with a Met, for them to all just be like, yeah, it's like, it's not even close.
Did you see the,
that says something to me.
Did you see the two things from the Braves that led me to believe that it's definitely happening?
I saw things from the Braves. Well, which ones were they?
Jones tweeted that DeGrom is hands down the Cy Young Award winner. And
right, okay. Yeah, I saw that.
Jones is a guy who I feel like is actually way more fair than you'd expect Chipper Jones to be when talking about other teams and things like that. But it right. still seems to me like when he comes down on the side of something, baseball writers listen because he's capital C Chipper, capital J Jones, you know? So there was that.
Right.
And then did you see what Freddie Freeman did last night?
That I don't know if I did see.
I had my son's back to school night, so I missed the first part of the game last night. But my father claimed that at one point, Freddie Freeman walked over and shook DeGrom's hand in the middle of the game. At the end of an inning, as one was walking off the field, he shook DeGrom's hand. And that's
right.
a classy move
well, yeah.
from Freddie Freeman. And
yeah.
if a division rival opposing player is recognizing your pitching dominance, then I can't see how the Baseball Writers of America can't do that.
It's not about the other guys at this point. It was just such a great season that, you know, Aaron Nola and Max Scherzer would have been totally respectable options for the award if DeGrom hadn't done this.
Or if he had a garbage September.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it, like, if those two guys were 1-2 in ERA and, you know, everything else with their seasons was pretty much just on par with what they've done, then sure, you know, it wouldn't be. And I'm really not trying to hate on Rick Porcello,
that's all right.
You know, that was, when you look at like the list of Cy Young winners, that one's kind of like, eh. And I know Justin Verlander was not happy about not winning that, and I'm not even saying that he should. But that was a year where it was just like the American League didn't really have an amazing pitcher. And you know, I mean, you still, if you're the best among all your peers, that's kind of the whole point of the award. So that's where I don't want to take it away from Porcello, but you know, it's not like any of these top three guys in the National League would have won a Cy Young, under those circumstances. Right. You know, they were all deserving, but by the time this all wrapped up, it wasn't even close.
I mean, the last couple of starts have just been the icing on the cake. What more did you want him to do?
Right.
You know? And there are still those old-timers who don't think he has enough wins, and I will never understand them. I just don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nice, and you know, for somebody who doesn't normally talk about wins, you know, it was nice that he finished with a 10-9 record.
Yes. It just gives people who like to complain about certain things one lesson to complain about.
Right.
And I understand that it's not DeGrom's fault that his entire baseball playing career from childhood till now has all been wrapped up in the idea of wins. Like, that's, you know, it's very different for us guys on the outside to say that wins don't matter. But if your whole life has been trying to achieve wins, I understand why that would be a hard reality to accept, just sort of, you know, without reservation. So,
yeah.
And, you know, I know you and Allison, and you guys did a great job, spent a whole bunch of last time's episode talking about Wright. But, you know, we're just a couple days away, Chris, from David Wright's last game as a Met. The contractually obligated to not call it retirement party is happening in like 48 hours from now. And, you know, I doubt either of our opinions have changed since the last episode was recorded. But as we're just a couple days away now, how are you feeling about all of this? Is this going to be as emotional and exciting and happy and sad as we all think it's going to be?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's some, so I'm not trying to rain on the parade at all. It's weird, right? Like, it's in the moment on Saturday, it's going to be, this is all about David Wright. The place is going to be packed. It's going to go nuts. Like, it's going to be cathartic, I think. And, you know, we all have our answer on, you know, what David Wright's career is, and being there, I'm sure is going to be awesome. So, like, that experience to me is something that people should absolutely look forward to. But being the Mets, there's some weirdness. You know, they activate him a few days before, and then they're like, well, he's not going to play. You know, the Braves are playing for home field. Like, what? what was that? If it was really only going to be this, just activate him on Friday or on Saturday right. You know? And
how would it, obviously tonight's game would have been different if Mesoraco did not enter the game and hit his home run. But really, in the scheme of the Mets season, how different would it have been if Wright was the pinch hitter instead of Mesoraco tonight?
Right.
You know, it's still the Mets.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, I've always been a full supporter of David Wright. And, you know, in that sense, like I was saying, the event itself should be incredible and a mix of, you know, super loud ovations and then also just sort of, you know, the sadness of the situation. But yeah, so my overall point, I guess, is don't let the Mets weirdness about all of it take away from the event. But it's just, it's odd. I guess would we really have it any other way? You know.
Has there been any real clarity about the difference between Wright's situation and officially calling it retirement in terms of his payment? Would he still get paid the same no matter what?
Yeah, I haven't really read like nitty gritty details on exactly what the scenario is moving forward. I mean, obviously, we all assume reasonably that doing it the way they're doing it will ensure that insurance is paying some of the money.
I know that is the case. But I'm wondering if, from Wright's perspective, if he makes any less, if he says it's a retirement.
Right. Yeah. Maybe.
I'm thinking back to when Michael Kadire retired, and I want to say they had to buy him out of something.
Yeah, right.
Does there
was
bell to the, you?
Yes, it does. It wasn't even that long ago.
Feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah, it that October, man. We between all the times that we had Amazing Avenue meetups at the bar in Midtown, you know, and then going to so many games and, you know, spectating the marathon, which is not running the marathon, but still, like, spectating the marathon and going to a World Series game in the same night. And, you know, unfortunately, that was the end of the World Series. But that was sort of a crazy span of like 4.5 weeks. And I did get a nasty cold after, like once it came down from all that, it was like, oh yeah, your body's like, that wasn't okay. It's time for you to pay for this. But yeah, I miss that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's nice that you can get into October and be like, all right, we're going to, you know, make plans and do all that kind of thing. But I do miss, you know, the potential World Series champion version of the Mets.
Yes. Agreed. But yeah, so I my overriding hope for Saturday is, well, it's two things. It's that Wright gets no balls hit to him so that there's not even a chance of him embarrassing himself in the field. Because I just think for all of our collective pride and all of our collective love of David Wright, to see him not make a play he used to make with ease would be tough to see. So that's my first hope. My second hope is that whoever's pitching for the Marlins grooves him a curveball and lets him just take a home run deep. Because the Marlins have nothing to play for either. Do the right thing here. Let the guy just drill a home run and then pull him out of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that would work. I was there, and it's funny when you hear, I am completely switching sports, but it's a New York sports thing that's relatable. So different circumstances, he still had a lot of good years left. But when Strahan was on the verge of the sack record and that final sack, Brett Favre, Strahan got there and Favre just was kind of like, all right, this is happening, you know. And Strahan's got a little bit of a sore spot about it that, you know, that people made it so much about that. And he's like, I had, you know, 21 and a half before that. Like I kicked ass all season and you know, so what? Like that was just the last one, but the other ones were all still part of it. So in that same spirit of Michael Strahan, who I think is, you know, one of the easiest guys to have rooted for as a New York sports fan. And, you know, so is David Wright. So I have no problem with exactly that happening. And you know what? Who cares? You know, if the Marlins could be that, and you would think, I don't know, they're supposed to be like the classy Marlins now with the, you know, the Jeter Mattingly era. I'm cool with it. I mean, if they want to throw like a nasty pitch and then Wright just turns it around for a home run, then hey, I'll. Like if that happens first, okay, that's even better.
What I can go back to is, you know, I was at Piazza's last game as a Met, and the next season he came back as a Padre, and Pedro grooved him a curveball to give him a home run on his first at bat home, and Pedro's basically admitted that now, right? That's what he did,
and I was at that game.
Were you? I was not at that one. But you know that was a. That's an instance of, you know, the Mets were competitive that year. And it was, yes, it was early in the season. It wasn't a big deal. But that home run potentially could have meant way more to Pedro than it could mean to any Marlin for the season.
Yeah.
So do the right thing, Marlins. Let Wright just hit a dinger off you. And, you know, let him have his emotional end to his career. And everybody will be happy in the long run. It's going to be weird. It's weird because, so, you know, you and I are about the same age. And so David Wright and Jose Reyes were the first players that I felt were my, like, you know, I am literally like 6 months older than David Wright. So, you know, they were my peers. And you appreciate those type of players differently than you when you're a kid. And you're looking up to somebody who is a larger than life figure who seems like, you know, they couldn't, like, if they don't operate on the same plane of existence that you operate on. But I know lots of guys in my day-to-day life who are, I mean, not as good as baseball as David Wright is, but are just like David Wright. Are those types of people? I recognize in him traits in people that I know. I know, you know, he's just, he was kind of one of us. And I think that's just a very different thing for me. Seeing that guy retire is hard.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, you know, being a sports fan, when you start to go like, oh, that guy's younger than me. That's weird.
By the way, I don't know if there's a single Met older than me at this point.
No?
I'm 36.
Vargas?
How old is Vargas?
The time-honored tradition of typing into Baseball Reference. Vargas is 35. He'll be 36 in February.
Is there anybody older than Vargas? I don't think Mesoraco is.
No, he's not. Bruce isn't.
Wright is a little bit older than Vargas, but I'm older than Wright.
Yeah.
I think I'm the old man.
There you go. Until they bring back Bartolo.
Yeah, of course. Or Ari Dickey, or both.
Can we just a quick mention of I don't want to pass by Dickey. I'd say both still. But Bartolo's commercial that he did for charcoal, I think.
Did you see it? I haven't seen it.
Oh man, so it's one of his teammates who I just didn't recognize in like the little tiny thumbnail Twitter video that I saw it on. But one of his teammates just being like, man, Bartolo, how do you do it? You know, you're so old. And Bartolo talks about there's no off season, and it shows him doing some training stuff, and then he shakes his belly, and then it cuts to him just picking up this like gigantic piece of meat. I guess technically it might be, I think it's a rib technically. Just this ridiculous thing, and takes a huge bite out of it, and then it's like, buy charcoal, you know. But that, yeah, if you have not seen it, just, I think it was Kingsford, I think was the brand. So I'm sure if you just Google Bartolo charcoal, you'll find the video. But if you have not seen it yet.
I really, truly, truly hope the Mets don't fuck this up on Saturday.
Yeah. Well, and I don't think this will happen. I think Wright is probably doing everything he can this week to make sure that Saturday is, you know, perfect. And I'm sure that no matter how much how good or bad he feels on Saturday, he's still going to go out and, you know, play this game. So I don't think there's any risk of that. But I'm sure somewhere in his mind, he's like, man, what if I wake up on Saturday and I'm just, you know, I can't go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that's there.
9 cortisone knowing shots.
Yeah, right? Yeah, like, oh, dude, just let's just do one and, you know, pretty much every part of my spine. But yeah, this being his final game, and the fact that they haven't used him at all, I doubt he's going to play at all on Sunday either. But I've never lacked faith in David Wright. So, you know, Nobody's ever had to say that I find your lack of faith in David Wright disturbing. So I have faith that he will do it one more time, and he'll do something, you know, whether it's a grooved pitch or not, he'll do something that everybody goes, man, that's the guy we remember. And he can go out on a high note, you know, and, yeah.
So here's a question I asked my brother last week, and I think you're going to have the same answer he had. If this were any other franchise, literally any other franchise, would they retire his number before the game on Saturday?
Or right after the game on Saturday? I'm trying to think. I would say no, only because they all like to like milk it for another sellout.
Or at least announce it. Like, you know. And David, after tonight, no player will ever wear number five again. Like, just say right. that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't expect the Mets to do that. I think a team, a hypothetical major league team, could do it.
I think any other franchise other than the Mets would do it.
Yeah.
Didn't they pretty much do that for Jeter when he retired?
I forget, but that, like, I forget we specifically, but that, yeah, that's right. But yeah, if the Wilpons were looking for a good PR move, they would go down on the field and take the heat for being themselves and, you know, just kind of either keep go poker face or smile and sort of just let people get their venting out at you and say, David, congratulations on a great career. We know you've always been a Met and you're always going to be a Met. You know, you are family to this organization, and, you know, we want to let you and our fans and the rest of baseball know tonight that, you know, we're going to retire number five. I'm not saying people would love them. They'd still hate them, you know, as soon as the next day. But, like, for once, they could just do something that they would speak and people would go nuts cheering. Like, what else could they say that would make 45,000 people happy
right
now?
We're selling the team.
We're selling the team, or we signed Machado
and Harper
and, like, a whole bullpen. Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much it. So,
yeah,
yeah.
So, again, I was out with my brother a week ago, and he's a Mets fan in exile out in Arizona, so he doesn't get to watch as many games. We were talking about it, and he said, like, who do you think are the Mets that are going to come back for this game? Like, who are the people who are Wright's teammates who are going to show up that you feel like this game couldn't happen without those guys there? And so I have a list of three or four, but I'm interested to hear if you have anybody other than who I have. So I'll give you a couple to give you time to warm up here. I think Cliff Floyd has to be there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they had, you know, sort of a tight relationship. Yeah.
And he sort of represents, like, when Wright, you know, was emerging, he was right there. I don't think Beltran has to be there. As much as I would love him to be there, I don't think, even though they played together a long time, I don't think of him in the same. I don't think of he and Wright as being particularly close. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about that. It didn't seem they were particularly tight. Some other players I thought about, Ty Wigginton, perhaps. You know, who played third base before Wright and sort of shepherded Wright into that position when he came up. I think Michael Kadire, his buddy. Two Kadire mentions in one podcast, by the way. This is a record since his retirement happened.
Since I was a Kadire fan with the jersey and all that.
Yep.
Yeah.
you never got the fedora, did you?
No, I wasn't that
not that much of a Kadire fan. Got it. Yeah. And then I think Piazza and Seaver, just because he now joins them as the Mount Rushmore of the Mets. And I hope that those guys come out like as representatives of what this means.
Yeah.
Am I forgetting anybody for you?
Yeah, no. No, I mean, so my mind went to the pillars of Mets player history. Those are the two guys, you know. It might be cool to have like the managers there. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean,
Jerry Manuel, maybe.
Yes. But you know, it's a kind of thing
did
where
he, come up
he
with
was
Art Howe?
He did, right?
He did, yeah. Yeah, so Art Howe, Willie Randolph, Jerry Manuel, Terry Collins. Yeah.
And then Callaway being there already. But yeah, no, it just not that you're trying to necessarily overdo it, but if it's rare for a baseball player to be named captain of a team. You know, so
Franco probably has to be there.
Yeah.
As another captain.
No, that's a good point. But yeah, no, just sort of being in that position that's unique, and not that he had that title for his entire career, but you know, this is somebody who obviously was always sort of seen as a leader on the team, which is why he got that title. So I'm sure the managers are all, you know, fairly close with him.
I wonder if like Steve Phillips, who drafted him, will be there.
Yeah, that could make sense.
I don't know how much of a pregame ceremony there's going to be.
Right.
But I really hope that the Mets really roll out the red carpet for him.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I would think, obviously, you could extend it to the Mets, that Mets family concept, you know. So, I mean, Horowitz is still there doing what he's doing. I would assume, like, Shannon Ford's family will probably be involved in some way because they were so close, you know. And you know, Shannon was the best. And, that'll just add another layer of emotion to everything. But I know that Wright had a really close relationship with her family. So, you know, you start thinking about all this stuff and it's, you know, quite a large group of people who can make sense, to be important parts of all this for him.
Yeah. Did you see him mention that he would like to be a part of the Mets front office next year?
Yes.
Make it happen, Mets.
Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with him, but but I love him for it. Like,
look, he's going to be collecting $20 million from them. He might as well do something.
I would love to see him go into broadcasting with A-Rod.
Yeah.
You know, like the two New York third basemen.
I feel like he's too nice to go into broadcasting.
He couldn't critique him enough. Right.
Oh man, he's trying hard. You know.
Right. Yeah, I do want to hear him in the booth.
Oh yeah,
though.
Yeah.
Like as an occasional drop in kind of thing. You know, it's and at times, you know, you just wonder. You know, what's the real, I think we get the real David Wright on a certain level, but I don't know. I just want to hear him be like, not necessarily get himself into trouble with his words like Keith sometimes does. That not that point, but you know, just, I don't know. Tell me a story about like why you hope this game ends so you can go home and like make sure you get to your favorite restaurant for steak,
yeah.
You know, before you get home. Something along those lines of just, you know, not your standard fair right quote.
You know, Wright is of that generation that has been media trained within an inch of their lives. So I don't know what it's going to take for him to, like, loosen up enough to be a good guest in the booth.
Because
this is no offense to the guy. He's not the most interesting interview out there.
Right.
You know, because he is just, every answer seems so perfectly trained. So we have to let him like have a spring training under Keith's direction.
Oh boy.
You know. And then hopefully he forgets half what Keith taught him and half of his media training and comes together into something really enjoyable.
Yeah. I'd love to, like, I'm picturing it sort of as, and I know Kiner had a long broadcasting career of his own before he sort of tapered it off, you know, later in his career and his life. But when he would drop in, there was a point when he would drop in maybe half a dozen times per season and be in the booth and just, you'd hear just stories and a perspective on the game and this warmth, you know. That's on my wish list of things David Wright could do that would, you know, he doesn't have to do a damn thing after Saturday. He could say, you know what, I don't really want to work in the front office. I'm just going to spend time being a family man. I'm going to be a Mets fan just like the rest of you. And he would be a legend for the franchise forever, you know, without doing anything else. You know, I like the concept of a guy who's like Kiner, you know, who, I mean, in his case, didn't even play for the team,
right,
but,
yeah,
you know, was just part of the fabric of the Mets because he was really good at what he did, and he was around for so long. So, you know, I guess that's my selfish wish.
So we need, like, Wright's corner.
Yeah. It's hard to do real alliteration, so just take the corner.
Right. I don't know. Or you can call it the hot corner. There we go. That's a way to honor Ralph Kiner and to give it to Wright. Call it the hot corner.
Yeah.
Mets, hire Chris and I to take care of this stuff. We'll produce the hot corner for you.
Yeah. Absolutely. I could hang out with David Wright. That would be fine.
Throw us some season tickets. We're good.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, that was good.
Yeah.
A chunk of time out of that.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, it's actually Saturday is mine and Aaron's wedding anniversary.
So oh, yeah, that's right.
At the game. But we'll nice. Be there. So if you're going to be there, like, shoot me a text or something. We'll meet up for a drink.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, there's sort of this day-to-dayness of everything. But given the updates today, if I want to go, I could probably pull it off. You know, like, and we've been, Diana and I have been pretty good.
Hey everybody, this is Steve Saipa, and this week I'm going to go over how the 2018 season went for the Binghamton Roma Ponies. So the team went 64-72, which was a pretty big drop as compared to the 2017 season where they went 85-55. But let's be honest, it wasn't a very good team that they were fielding. That didn't stop eyes from being glued to the Binghamton team, though, when the year started. Last year, people were interested because of the name change, the new logo, and rebranding, and all that stuff. And this year, people were interested not because of Peter Alonso, not because of Jeff McNeil, but Tim Tebow. Those two other guys obviously would become the main stories of the 2018 Rumble Ponies, but at first, everyone was fixated on Tebow. He didn't deserve to be in AA. How would he do in AA? He sucks. You suck. The Mets suck. Blah, blah, blah. So almost 5,240 people braved that 35-degree weather on opening day, which is an increase from 4,680. So that's a pretty big increase as compared to 2017. And in that game, Peter Alonso homered in the bottom of the first. Tim Tebow homered a few batters later. And then the next inning, Jeff McNeil homered. And to Tebow's credit, he didn't embarrass himself as the season progressed and those early weeks became, you know, months. His season ended prematurely on July 19th after he broke his right hamate bone. But he got into 84 games and he hit 273, 336, 399. And that's not bad. To put that in context, that's a better batting line that Patrick Mazeika put up in a similar amount of games. It's a better batting line than Matt Oberstee put up. It's a better batting line than John Mora put up. That's a better batting line than Andrew Eli put up. Obviously, none of those guys are, like, actual prospects. Oberstee got released. Eli was a waiver claim that basically just organizational depth. And Mazeika and Mora are just kind of depth guys. But nobody questions their baseball credentials. And Tebow out-hit, quote-unquote, actual ball players. I was just as doubtful about the whole Tebow thing when he signed. You know, I thought the signing was hilarious because of how bent out of shape people are getting about it and the whole media circus that it was creating. But at this point, Tebow is, I don't know. I mean, he's not a prospect. He isn't a quad A depth guy. Maybe he is. But I guess he's like a kind of secondary role player, minor league guy that people are cognizant of. You know, Champ Stewart's, the Johan Urania's, Mickey Janis's. Guys that most people that have some awareness of the minors, they don't give you blank looks at when you bring up their names. Tebow is one of those guys, except more like Christian-y. But Tebow aside, the real storyline of the 2018 Binghamton Rumble Pony season was Peter Alonso and Jeff McNeil. Alonso, ever since he made some changes to his swing and his approach last June, he's been on fire, so it's easy to predict that he'd have some success. But McNeil kind of came out of nowhere. The signs were there, if you know where to look. And it's not like nobody could have predicted that he'd have success, though maybe not as much success as he had. But he bulked up a few seasons ago. He adjusted his swing to, you know, include more loft and have a greater launch angle. And, you know, it was just his health that was keeping him down. We ranked him here, the Mets' 21st top prospect, and we were the Amazing Avenue was the only Mets-centric list to include McNeil, and I gotta say, that was all Greg and Lucas. I jumped off the McNeil train last year, and literally that was the worst time to jump off it. That'd be like selling my stock right before the company took off. Jeff and Jared at BP, they're also in on McNeil for a while before his breakout. Went from, you know, small sample to a considerable chunk of the season. And Jeff was really one of the first people to report on McNeil's muscle gains a few years ago and conclude that it was legit. But McNeil turning to a legit player, it's a pretty huge boon for the Mets. They have a pretty long history of trading away middle infielders right before they blossom and missing out on the gains. Jeff Kepinger, Justin Turner, Daniel Murphy. So it's nice that the team might actually for once get to taste the fruit of that. But outside of Alonso and McNeil, and then to a lesser degree, credit where credit's due, Tebow, there's a lot of schlock getting on the field. Two guys, Nick Sergakis and Matt Oberstee, they were given their releases during the season. Tyler Moore was sent packing after the season ended. And things weren't that much better on the pitching side either. Mickey Janis and Neville Chrismat, they anchored the rotation, and regardless of their actual upsides, they're guys that could handle double-A pitching. But after them, it got hairy. Justin Dunn, he was promoted to Binghamton in June, and he was very hit and miss. Marcus Molina was just terrible, and he got released midseason. Andrew Church, also terrible, and he retired midseason. Harold Gonzalez, he got promoted mid-year. And he didn't have a very good showing for himself, though I do think that he gets the hang of double-A and is a better player next year. Franklin Killame, he was acquired midseason. That was an amazing acquisition, a great trade. And hopefully he blossoms next year, but he was kind of eh in his seventh start. And that basically was the rotation. The bullpen was decent. It actually looked like a strength at times. Daniel Zamora and Ty Bachelor, they made their major league debuts, and that's great. And Ryder Ryan and Steven Valines probably will next year, or maybe the year after, but sometime in the near future. And then there's a big group of toss-up guys, Eric Hanhold, Steve Nogasek, David Roseboom, Joshua Torres, Corey Taylor, Matt Blackham, Austin McGeorge, Adonis Huseda. They could all possibly get MLB innings. But those 2018 Rumble Ponies will be the first class of Syracuse Mets next year, so things might be a little iffy in Syracuse next year. And the 2018 St. Lucie Mets, they're going to be the 2019 Binghamton Rumble Ponies, and that means that things might be a little down in Binghamton again next year. I'll go over who those St. Lucie Mets are and why things aren't looking good for Binghamton next year, next week.
Mason Avenue podcast listeners, Allison McCaig here with another installment of the Degrometer and the Mnemometer, where I give you updates on the stellar seasons of two of our favorite Mets, Jacob DeGrom and Brandon Nimmo. It's quite a happy Degrometer and Mnemometer this week. I have a little bit more stats to give you this week than usual because it's been about 10 days since I last recorded this segment. So we have two DeGrom starts to go over. So he started on Sunday, September 16th against the Red Sox. He gave up three runs over seven innings of work on five hits with one walk and a dozen strikeouts. He looked absolutely lethal early in this start, and he was mowing down the Sox in the first couple of innings. He struck out six of the first seven batters he faced, and that was going toe-to-toe with Chris Sale as well, which is saying something. But with one out in the third, the powerful Red Sox offense struck. He gave up two singles and then a long sack fly to Mookie Betts that was hit to the absolutely deepest part of Fenway Park. And honestly, it would have been a home run many, many places. But then Brock Holt immediately gave one a ride after that. And this time the ball went out, so DeGrom was tagged for three runs in that frame. But as always, DeGrom was completely unflappable, and he held the Red Sox there. He gave up just two hits the whole rest of the way to get through seven innings, and his dozen strikeouts were the most any pitcher has managed against the Red Sox lineup this year, so that's saying something too. The Mets were actually able to tie it up in the top of the seventh to get DeGrom off the hook for the loss before Seth Lugo gave up the game-winning run. So the Mets lost the game, but DeGrom didn't get the loss. DeGrom's ERA rose ever so slightly by 0.07 points to put him at 1.78 for the year at that point. And then he remained 8-9 on the season at that point. It may have been a quote-unquote bad start by DeGrom's standards, and he said as much after the game that he wasn't happy with his effort, but against the best team in baseball, keeping his quality start streak alive, especially bouncing back from a rough inning like he had, was still really incredible and seriously impressive nonetheless. His most recent start was on Friday night against the Nationals. Again, he went seven innings. This time he only gave up one run on three hits. He walked one batter and struck out eight batters. For once, DeGrom was actually handed a lead before he even took the mound, as the Mets scored a run in the first inning. But after a quick and easy first inning, DeGrom lost his command a little bit in the second. He issued a leadoff walk to Anthony Rendon, and then he got 3-0 on Juan Soto. He worked the count back full to Soto. Devin Mesoraco actually went out to the mound to talk to him, and then he buckled down and went 3-2 on Soto, worked the count back full, but then Soto singled, and Ryan Zimmerman hit a sacrifice fly to tie the game. But after the second inning ended with DeGrom picking off Wilmer Defoe off first base, he went into complete cruise control and was unhittable virtually after that. He only allowed two base runners for the whole rest of the outing, and the Mets scored three runs in the top of the third to give him a 4-1 lead to work with, and that turned out to be plenty for him. The Mets bullpen bent, but it did not break this time, and the Mets won 4-2 to get DeGrom back to 500 on the season at 9-9, and it was also his 23rd quality start, which is the most in a row that any pitcher has ever recorded in the history of baseball in one season. So breaking records left and right every time he takes the mound. You know, this is likely his penultimate start of the season. He likely gets just one more. In order for him to get multiple starts, he would have to pitch on short rest. And I think that's unlikely, and I don't really see a reason for him to do that at this point. If people are either going to take wins into account or they're not. I don't think an extra start is really going to do DeGrom, make any difference for DeGrom one way or the other in the Cy Young race. But So it's likely his penultimate start. So no matter what happens against the Braves this week, DeGrom will have had a fantastic season and one to remember. So let's go over the season stats. He's thrown 209 innings now, and he has a 1.77 ERA for the whole season, a 0.94 whip, a 2.03 FIP, 11.15 strikeouts per nine innings, 1.98 walks per nine innings, 0.43 home runs per nine innings, and a 211 ERA plus. So that is something historic. That's something that the Mets have not seen since the likes of Doc Gooden and Tom Seaver. This is a season that we're going to remember for a really long time, even if there wasn't a lot of things to remember about 2018. This was one of them. So his 8.3 Fangraphs WAR on the season is first among pitchers in the National League by far. Max Scherzer has a 6.8, and Aaron Nola has a 5.5. Baseball Reference WAR, again, Nola has the lead there, like he has done all year, with a 9.8 BWAR for pitchers, but DeGrom has been inching ever closer, because Nola and Scherzer have both struggled in their recent starts, whereas DeGrom has stayed, pretty good. So, DeGrom's inching ever closer. It used to be that Nola had like a whole win lead on DeGrom and BWAR, but DeGrom's up to a 9.2 now, compared to Nola's 9.8, and Scherzer is at 8.3. But if you look at Baseball Reference, Baseball Reference WAR altogether, not just for pitchers, that takes hitting into account and things like that. DeGrom actually leads now. So he has a 9.7 WAR. And Nola has 9.3 and Scherzer has 9.2. So the other thing that I think is worth pointing out, is that the position player with the highest Fangraphs WAR in the National League is currently Christian Yelich at a 6.6. And remember, DeGrom's at an 8.3. So DeGrom's almost two wins ahead of the nearest position player atop the NL in WAR. So DeGrom is not only getting Cy Young buzz at this point, but he's getting MVP buzz as well. A few of us in Mets world and Amazing Avenue world have been talking about DeGrom for MVP for a little while now, but it's entering the national conversation a little bit. It's worth noting that in 2014, Clayton Kershaw won the MVP, which is probably the best comp we can come up with in recent history for as far as starting pitchers winning the MVP. And other than wins, Kershaw did not have better numbers than DeGrom has now, and he was only 0.2 Fangraphs WAR ahead of the nearest position player that year, Andrew McCutchen, who had a fantastic season that season. Although DeGrom is ahead in all the polls for the Cy Young, I would be shocked at this point if he won the MVP, just because of the team's losing record and his own unlucky 500 record. It probably has more pull there in the MVP conversation than it does in the Cy Young conversation at this point. His lack of wins, the team's not being in contention. Still, in a year with no obvious MVP in the National League, he has a case, and I think it's a pretty strong one. And in fact, Fangraphs just wrote an article recently arguing that DeGrom should win the NL MVP, saying that, in part, despite the fact that DeGrom is pitching for a non-contending team, like I said, he does lead the league in win probability added, which says something about the leverage of the situations he's pitching in. And we've been over and over the fact that DeGrom, by far, has pitched the most innings of anyone with a one run margin of error, as in he's either leading by one run, down by one run, or the game is tied. He leads the league by far in innings pitched in that scenario. So yeah, maybe the team isn't in contention, maybe the games aren't important, but he's still pitching in very high leverage situations almost all the time. Almost every inning he pitches is a high leverage inning. So that says something. You know, I recommend looking at that article, the one that Fangraphs wrote, if you have a chance to. It also takes a look at pitchers winning the MVP historically and how far they've been ahead of the nearest position player in WAR, et cetera, et cetera. It looks at Bob Gibson and others. So you should go check that out. But meanwhile, DeGrom for MVP, Fangraphs, one of us, one of us. So definitely beating that MVP drum now. I'm getting greedy. I don't just want the Cy Young. I want the MVP. It's not happening, but I want it. So we talked a lot about DeGrom. Let's talk about Brandon Nimmo. Since September 13th, when I last recorded one of these segments, Nimmo has had 53 plate appearances, and he's put up rather interesting numbers, so we're going to talk about them. He isn't getting a lot of hits, but as per usual, he's drawing a ton of walks. So his slash line's a little weird. He's slashing 167, 434, 333, which is good for a 131 WRC+. So he has just 6 hits in that span in 53 plate appearances, hence the 167 batting average. 2 singles, 3 doubles, and a home run. That home run came on the Saturday game at Fenway that put the Mets ahead 3-1 at the time. But he still walked a whopping 13 times in that span in 53 plate appearances and struck out just 8 times. And he was also hit by 4 pitches. So he's not rocking a very high batting average, but he's still getting on base in an extremely high clip. So his on-base ability has been elite this season, and that's continuing to show even when he doesn't get his base hits. So on the season so far, as it's coming to close to a close, he has 517 plate appearances, and he's slashing 261, 397, 483 overall with 110 hits, 17 home runs, 47 RBIs, 76 runs scored, and 9 stolen bases. His 146 WRC+ is second in the National League to Christian Yelich, and his 147 OPS plus is second in the National League to Christian Yelich on the season. He has accrued a 4.4 Fangraphs WAR, which is actually 13th in the NL, so getting pretty close to cracking the top 10 in the National League overall, which is incredible. And he has 4 baseball reference WAR, and he actually has cracked the top 10 when it comes to baseball reference in offensive WAR at 4.7. He's 9th there. In the National League. So, let's take a minute to compare Brandon Nimmo's first half with his second half, because I think it's interesting. Both of them have been great. But the numbers are pretty revealing, I think. So, in the first half, Brandon Nimmo slashed 253, 373, 490 with an 863 OPS, a 140 WRC+, and he walked 11.9% of the time and struck out 28.9% of the time. Okay? Internalize that. Second half numbers. He's slashing 273, 432, 472 with a 904 OPS, a 156 WRC+, and he has a 17.5 walk percentage and a 22.3 strikeout percentage. So overall, he's shown a little less power in the second half, but he's actually increased his average and on-base percentage and shown consistent elite on-base ability the whole season. He's also striking out even less and walking even more in the second half, which is saying something. I think it's shown that he's even developed as a player. Even though he started out with such a stellar first half, he's even developed in the second half, despite a couple of hit-by-pitches punctuating this and leaving him sidelined for a couple weeks at a time. So I think that says something about the player that he's becoming. And if that doesn't excite you, combined with Michael Conforto's second half and what Jeff McNeil is doing at the plate, if that all isn't something to be excited about, man, I don't know what it is. That's pretty great. So if Brandon Nimmo, Michael Conforto, and Jeff McNeil can be the players that we've seen them be in the second half this year, and throw in Ahmed Rosario into that pot as well, we've got something here. I just saw, I know this isn't the McNeil-o-meter or the Conforto-meter, but I just saw a stat today that Jeff McNeil put up the same amount of FWAR in his 57 games as Yoenis Cespedes did in his 2015 post-trade to the Mets during that summer and fall when they were making the stretch run in those 57 games. That is seriously impressive. Now, that is with the huge caveat that at the time Yoenis Cespedes was playing center field, that significantly probably dampened his WAR numbers, because his defensive numbers probably took a big hit for that, because he's not really a center fielder, he's a corner outfielder. But that said, putting up that amount of WAR in such a short period of time is seriously something else. So Brandon Nimmo, even evolving as a player, despite having an elite first half, having an elite second half with elite you know, on-base ability is something to be excited about for the future. And combine that with Conforto's second half, what McNeil is doing, what Rosario is doing. We have a serious core to work with. So, you know, even if everything else sucks, we have those things. So hopefully the next time I join you with one of these segments, DeGrom will have thrown his last start and it will have been awesome. And maybe I'll even get to tell you that he won the Cy Young. We'll see. So, you know, things are looking up in the DeGrometer and the mnemometer. So I'll be joining you again soon with what will likely be the final, DeGrometer and mnemometer for the season. It's been a pleasure. So I hope you enjoyed this segment and, I'll catch you in your feeds again soon.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. We truly, truly appreciate it. If you're going to be at the game on Saturday, please say hi. I will be at the game with my wife. It is our 11th wedding anniversary. So don't let that dissuade you, I guess. So I'm already killing the romance by bringing her to David Wright's last game. But, you know, we're going to be walking around probably at the Shea Bridge, probably behind section, I think it's 121 is our usual hangout spot. So we'll be there. A lot of Amazing Avenue is coming out. So tweet at us, at Amazing Avenue, at Brian Needs an App, at Chris McShane, at Petite PhD, at Steve Saipa. Be lots and lots of us there. So tweet at us. We'll maybe get together and hang out and share a drink or at least, you know, clink glasses as you walk by. So please reach out if you're going to be at the game on Saturday. I'm sorry we didn't do another game meetup this year. It just didn't work out with the end of the season kind of spiraling into David Wright insanity. But, you know, we're going to do something really fun for episode 300 in a few weeks. So details forthcoming for that. And, yeah, we're going to do a game next year for sure. So until then, though, please go to AmazingAvenue.com where you can read all your Mets news and analysis that you could ever possibly want. We're going to be having a GM hunt soon. We're hopefully going to be signing Manny Machado soon. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. So lots to cover in the offseason, so check that out. You can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can get this show from blogtalkradio.com, from Stitcher, or from Apple Podcasts, or really from wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. That helps us quite a bit. And, yeah, I went through the Twitter handles before, so follow us, tweet at us on Saturday, and Saturday and beyond, let's go Mets. Thank you, David Wright.